Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Economics and Business History channel of the New Books Network. My name is Paula de la Cruz Fernandez, a host on the channel. Today, I interview New York writer Benjamin Lohr. Benjamin Lohr is the author of Hellbent, a book that explores the Bikram yoga community and movement. And the book for which we are meeting today, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket, published in 2020. The Secret Life of Groceries takes the reader to hidden, dark parts of supermarket life in the US and of the globalized world of supply chains that are connected to this to the supermarket. Specifically, Lohr's book talks about stores like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, Aldi. But what's more important, this book goes deeper into the side of the story that the consumer is most certainly not aware of unless he or she is a worker of this vast and growing industry that is the business of groceries. Lohr argues, however, that the consumer is not marginal to this story because we are the ones that embrace and crave packaged, even cartoony-looking labels. Consumers in the US want new snacks, new products to put in and on our bodies. Not even fishermen in Thailand are outside of this chain. As Lohr concludes his book, what the fishermen at the end of the supply chain in Thailand wanted after this this specific case, after he had accumulated some cash, was to go back to his village to build up a grocery store. The entire chain, from the point of sale in Whole Foods, Bowery, New York, to Thailand, was what Lohr calls a dark, has what Lohr calls a dark side, an almost concealed chain of links, of truckers riding across the nation working for $100 a week to migrant forced labor in Thailand, which is what makes possible to have these aisles and aisles of perfectly organized goods all the time in our grocery stores, in our supermarkets here in the United States. The Secret Life of Groceries also takes us back to how some of these intricate commodity chains and complex economic systems evolved in American history. And that is also why I'm so glad to have Benjamin Lohr here with us today in this channel of economic and business history. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we start with the book, can you tell us a bit more about yourself? Because it is common to invite academics to this channel, and I was so excited when you agreed to be interviewed. If you can tell us a bit more about your background and how this project came about.
Sure. So I definitely wouldn't self-describe as an academic. I'm a writer first, a nonfiction writer. I you know, I have a background in education. It's an entire parallel life where I was a high school teacher. And I think that actually plays into a lot of my writing in the sense that education is a very nurturing community of like nurturing personalities who are really, education is about educing or like pulling behavior out of people. And when I approach my nonfiction projects, it's kind of with a similar energy that I'm trying to let characters speak for themselves and let people tell their own stories. And I'm trying to get as close to them as possible while they're telling their stories. So some people call this like immersive journalism, where I'll kind of like throw myself into various situations. So for my first book, Hellbent, which was the exploration of the Bikram yoga community, I just did gobs and gobs of Bikram yoga and got very close to that world. And ultimately, the book was pretty dark in that it was a kind of a pre-Me Too story of an abusive sexual predator guru, Bikram Chowdhury. But I think a lot of the storytelling really, and the reason that I uncovered and broke that story was because I got close to people and they came to trust me and see me as somebody who would tell their story on their terms rather than on my terms. And so that's how I approached the grocery industry, which is not a cult yoga community, but is a claustrophobically secretive industry full of very low margins, lots of trade secrets, people who believe that, you know, they're going to be betrayed or their proprietary information will be, you know, someone will be able to take advantage of them. And I, in a similar manner, just tried to get as close to various people in the supply chain as I could, whether by working alongside them, tracking them down to where they live, following them on their rounds, as they went about their day, or just like copious interviews with them. And so that's kind of my approach as a writer. And then, you know, you couple that with lots and lots of research on the back end to kind of fill in the cracks.
Yeah, no, it is a fascinating book. I really enjoyed it. But it's really dark. Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what, you know, every time I go to the grocery store now, I think twice. Your book starts with a gruesome scene of how the fish decks of Whole Foods are cleaned every day. You don't seem to define it really clean.
But... No, definitely not every day. Probably every other month or once a month to every other month.
Okay.
Which is probably the problem in that scene.
Okay. But you actually, what your book does really well, I think, is that it goes from the top to the bottom of this supply chain. And you start with, that a scene which kind of makes the reader know that we are entering a very dark story. But let's start with Trader Joe's, because that's when you meet actually the top of the, you know, of the supply chain, and you meet with the founder. Tell us more about how you know the story of Trader Joe's and when you met with Joe Colin.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I would say it's funny, a lot of people, you're 100% right that a lot of people think the book is very dark. I don't think of it as very dark, or maybe I just think of the world as kind of a dark place in general. And your story is certainly no more or less dark than a lot of other aspects of our world. And so that opening metaphor you talked about, I really like. So it's not just a metaphor. In the book, I go and as you know, but someone who hasn't read the book might, I go and look at the cleaning of the fish case at a Whole Foods, which over the course of the month that they don't clean it gets absolutely horrifically disgusting on the bottom. And there's all sorts of rotting fish and nasty things. But at the top where they're selling the fish, you know, separated by all this ice, it's very hygienic. It's clean. It smells good. And the fish are perfect for sale. And so for me, that distance where something can simultaneously have that hygienic, clean qualities and be covering up nastiness, for me is really what the grocery industry is all about. Like it really is a dark miracle in that it's a beautiful thing that provides so much for us, but a lot of that comes with the pain. But yeah, to go to your question on Trader Joe's, I mean, Trader Joe's is just a fascinating place. And so I was lucky enough to spend time with Joe Kalum, who's the founder and president of Trader Joe's. He founded the chain back in the mid-60s, and it was actually an outgrowth of an earlier chain that he had started in the 1950s. And really, Trader Joe's was central. When I was first pitching this book to editors, Trader Joe's was the thing I wanted to understand, because I had never seen anything like it before. I didn't grow up with a Trader Joe's, but actually I was researching that Bikram book, and I remember I went with a group of yogis to a Trader Joe's, and they got so excited about being inside this grocery store. It was like kids in an amusement park where they were like giddy and grabbing all these different items from the frozen things and bringing them to me to show them to me. And I just couldn't believe there were grown adults who were this excited about a grocery store. And then, of course, the people who work at Trader Joe's are notoriously happy and, well, like smiley, like almost pathologically chirpy. So that I became really interested in how this place existed, that one created so much of an attraction between the consumers there, managed to keep its employees happy, and was seemingly a place of high value with low prices, or at least perceived as low prices. So it was this fascinating, you know, for me, it was a fascination. Like, I wanted to understand what made it tick. And I guess I walked in thinking like, oh, there must be some scam here. You know, there must be some, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So you can't have happy, well-paid employees, low prices, and like the most unique products on the planet. And to some extent, there are the same problems that befall all of grocery stores fall upon Trader Joe's. But Joe did some very unique things that help kind of both understand why Trader Joe's is legitimately unique and how the grocery system as a whole functions. So he kind of broke with tradition in these ways, which is like most grocery stores are predicated on volume. Like I said, it's a very low margin industry. We're talking 1.5 to 3.5% margins, which is just tiny. So they have to make their money on volume. And that means for years, people would thought that they just had to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, have more offerings, more products, and you're going to have more volume. And therefore, you're going to eke out more money through your low margin. And essentially in America, almost all grocery stores to this day use that. And historically, they've just crept upward from the first supermarket in 1930 was about 9,000 square feet, which is a little less than half the size of a convenience store of today, to the Walmart superstores of today, which are 125,000, you know, these epic giant, you know, airplane hangars of a store. And they're also based on this idea of continuity, which is that whatever you want is going to be there. And it's something that as a consumer, we take for granted. But the grocery store manager is kind of in this constant scramble to put in and ensure that the things that we expect are on the shelf, like a stock out or an unavailable item, is the horror of most grocery store managers. And that sets them up in certain ways where they can only stock their store with certain items that are in the commodity game and that are available in continuous supply. And therefore, when you're a store, you really can only compete with other stores on those terms. And what Trader Joe's did was, one, Joe recognized that he was just a small guy. This was back in the 60s when he was just founding. And he could never compete with the larger stores, or rather the only way for him to compete with those stores was to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that was always going to be an unstable race to the top, where one or two people max could exist there, and they would win on having a low price, and everyone else would kind of be in their shadow. And he saw that way before it became true, but of course this is what's happened to the marketplace. There's been massive consolidation in grocery since his time. You know, right now we occupy a place where Walmart is the number one purveyor of organics, like semi-ironically in many people's minds, but a number one grocer in America. precisely because they can grow that big. And their only real competition probably is going to be Amazon, who, aside from acquiring Whole Foods, is getting into grocery in a big way, and also promises that kind of size advantage. And Joe recognized this, and he decided he just didn't want to play that game. So he slashed his inventory, which allowed, you know, I should say one of the consequences of this volume is that the buyers for the grocery store never can get much expertise over the product lines they're buying, because the average store to this day has about 45,000 individual items. The bigger ones have, again, in the hundreds of thousands of individual items. Those are just numbers that as a human, you can't get mastery over 15,000 items that are in your category. It's just not a sensible, the human brain isn't meant for that. What you have to do is you end up as just kind of clicking on replenishment buttons and just treating everything like it's widgets or numbers that you're buying more of, and taste and production values and ethics and all of those get subsumed, or not paid attention to nearly as much. So that, Joe decided he wanted to empower his buyers. He wanted to cut down his offerings and let his buyers kind of get expertise. So at one point, Trader Joe's was down to about 1,500 as opposed to 100,000 in these big stores items. And that really allowed his buyers to kind of understand the supply chains better and therefore innovate for their consumers. And in kind of the same like Steve Jobsian way of creating products that his consumers didn't even necessarily know they wanted. And so these would be adjacencies. For instance, it's really hard to compete for the lowest price on peanut butter, no matter how smart your buyers are, because it's a commodity good. It's pumped out in continuous design. But if you study the nut production line, you understand its nuances, you could start to grind almonds, which, you know, in the mid-70s was unheard of. It takes a slightly different machinery than grinding peanuts. But that's an adjacent product that Joe figured, or Joe's nut buyer, a guy named Doug Rao, figured his consumers would want. And so he started doing that and then do that all through the product line. So instead of trying to maniacally get the best price on canola oil or vegetable oil, get into something that, you know, now is more commonplace, but then would be obscure, like avocado oil, and get the best price on that, and then educate your consumers around that so they understand it. And his big example that he told me was, of course, canned corn. He was vintage dating canned corn, and selling it to consumers with like a complicated backstory about how it was all sold from this one field, I think in Idaho, but I can't remember exactly where it was. And he would have to compete with Japanese buyers for the rights to this one field. And then he would put it in a can, put a date on it. And all of a sudden this product that is kind of in our minds, definitionally commodity, definitionally continuous, canned corn, as boring as you could get, gets a story behind it, becomes differentiated, and can become, you can price discriminate on it so that people think they're getting a great value on canned corn, especially if it does taste better. And so that's some of the intricacy of Trader Joe's, but that's actually only a small taste, but enough because I've rambled.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
No, but that is, you made lots of good points, is that also this idea of big everything in one place. But then Aldi is probably, you know, the opposite to that. And that's, you know, and it has had also a successful story in the US. I mean, I buy at Aldi just because I don't have to choose.
Yeah, absolutely. Aldi's and Trader Joe's are very similar. And in fact, as you know, Aldi's acquired Trader Joe's in the late 70s. And they did that because they recognized that this was a business model that they understood and that was very different from all the other grocers in America, which were sizing up. Aldi was born out of World War II and kind of the destruction of Germany in World War II. And they built up these very small stores that, as you said, kept very low SKU counts, individual item counts, and would spend almost no money on advertising. It was a very low frill thing. And they would just use manufacturers and have them compete off each other. So float a price for a jar of mayonnaise that they could sell, and then have several manufacturers compete on that price, sell it with almost no markup. And it became an almost impossible model for people to beat. And so it grew very quickly. And then, you know, Trader Joe's is very, very similar, except for instead of no frills, although Trader Joe's has almost no advertising budget, they couple a lot of marketing. And so Joe put a lot of emphasis on targeting a specific demographic of consumers. He kind of recognized that there was going to be this growing professorial traveler class that didn't really exist in America in the 1950s, but would. It was kind of concomitant with the growing middle class. These people who are, you know, he called them overeducated, underpaid, Volvo driving professors that would want to eat the way they thought. They were learning new vocabulary. These were often people who are coming into the middle class with parents who hadn't gone to college. So they were learning new words and they were traveling to new places. Travel, you know, the 747 really democratized travel. And that was something that Joe seized upon. And so they were going to want to eat differently. And so unlike Aldi's, he started coupling a lot of, you know, you could call it marketing buzzwords or you could call it different appealing phrases and ideas that would really appeal to this set. And that kind of further honed the products that he was selling.
Yeah, no, fascinating story. My favorite part of the book, and that this goes with Aldi, was actually your experience with Tracker Lean or Line. I just could not stop reading about all the little bits that make up this very difficult job and life. And when you finish the book, you revealed that Lynn was close to be broke and with not a lot of alternatives for her to be employed somewhere else, mostly because of how much this job takes from anyone that works in these fleets of trucks. And you also mentioned that many married couples worked together as truckers. If you can tell us a bit more about, you know, the case of Lynn and other women and trucking in America, but also I'm intrigued by your perspective on how the industry is shaped by gender and race and how has trucking evolved as a masculine? I mean, you say there's 5% of truckers that are women. that as a masculine, white, blue collar job, and thus anyone not part of those categories is in some way undermined, underrepresented. They don't get to have this dream job that apparently is what they sell you at the beginning, and have a difficult time in the job, right? Because they don't feel like they belong, they cannot make their ends meet. If you can talk a little bit about that.
It's all exactly right. And it was very different than I think than my mentality walking into the book as to truckers. You know, I had this mentality that truckers were these blue collar teamsters, Jimmy Hoffa, kind of Smokey and the Bandit, outlaws. They were middle class ultimately, and living a job that maybe I was secretly even envious of, and thought maybe I would like to be a trucker for a few years. You know, I don't know if I want to do it forever, but it sounded kind of fun. And the truth is that trucking is an industry that has been deregulated over the last 40 years to a place where the trucker has been, right, you know, basically turned into a disposable part of that system. It's really good rendering of what can happen when we use an abstract word like deregulation. Basically going back to the late 70s, early 80s, when trucking was kind of a more regulated cartel industry with only a few characters and was thus very easily unionizable, they expanded the number of carriers, which allowed just about anyone who wanted to get involved in the industry to get involved. And that caused the trucking industry to reinvent its model into one where it was trying to, you know, it's competing pretty ruthlessly on price. And so the individual trucker is also competing on price. And it's very, very hard to find and land a good trucking job at this point, which I can basically only, I mean, probably the most helpful way of categorizing it is just with the stats. The annual turnover rate for the trucking industry over the last 10 years is between 95 and 116%. That's like pretty crazy. That means that in any given year, 100% of the people who are hired leave that job, whether because they just quit in disgust or are fired or move to another job. But nobody is sticking around in these jobs. They're not lifer jobs anymore. The reason they're not lifer jobs is because they're pretty terrible. You're trapped in a truck. You often sleep in the same place that you're working all day in a little bed in the back. You're working 70 hours a week minimum. Because that's the federal, I mean, it's both the minimum and the maximum that you're allowed to work. There are large, you know, according to federal law, which because it's in a race to the bottom is what you have to work to survive. And you're often, like you said, we're lured into the profession with the promise of good wages, and the trucking industry often gets these new recruits to take out lots of debt, because you need a commercial truck driving license, which is not something that you can get on your own. You know, you have to take classes for it. So you take out student debt to get your license. And then often you'll take out even further debt to become what's known as an owner operator of your own truck, which is essentially just a lease agreement on your truck. But it turns you into someone who's beholden to a single carrier, the person who's given you the money for your CDL or for your truck, will write into that contract, you can no longer compete on the open labor market. You can only take loads from me. So amidst this rock bottom labor market, you're all stuck with one person. And often for a large part of that, because you're still a trainee and you're still new and you don't necessarily have that CDL yet, or you just have it and are still learning how to be a professional driver, you'll be being paid even substandard training rates, which are lower than even, you know, normal rates. All of which just adds up to a labor market that can't really move around freely, is stuck in a actually physically grueling conditions. And if they don't play ball, because it's in their contract, they can't go to another company and work, are really stuck with the position they're in and can't negotiate. So they either have to stay put or get bounced out of the industry as a whole and take on enormous debt in the process. It's a staggeringly oppressive industry for anyone. And then, like you said, I think, which is true pretty much for any sociological finding these days, that all of the oppressions that exist for anyone are, you know, more true for women and you know, minorities, that, you know, these oppressions are just compounded when it resides on them. In a trucker, any trucker is extremely vulnerable. You know, you're out in the middle of nowhere on these roads on the highway, by yourself if you're by yourself, or with a partner if you're driving team, which is where two drivers just alternate shifts. Back, one person sleeps in the back, and you're essentially living in a small box with a stranger. That's a terrible situation to be if you're a man, if you're a macho man, stuck with another macho man who's extremely aggravated. But if you're a woman, of course, it's a whole nother level of vulnerability because you're, you know, stuck living with this man. And every woman that I talked to over the course of the book had a story of being sexually harassed, sexually assaulted, or knowing somebody who was sexually harassed or sexually assaulted in a very, you know, intimate way. Like, these weren't just stories that they heard as gossips, but they had a friend who was raped, or they themselves were assaulted by their trainer. Because it's just structurally set up that way when you're sitting and working inside of your home with another stranger. It's as an industry, it's a lot grimmer than I gave it credit for. But in another way, it's actually very emblematic of the labor market as a whole in a lot of groceries, which is all these low prices that consumers are getting, and there's no doubt that deregulation has delivered that, come with big cuts to laborers.
Right. Yeah, no, I thought it was brutal. You mentioned in the introduction, you mentioned this concept of the business of desire. And I was also very interested in that idea. And you talk about, you know, this design, this process that goes into the design of snacks and food trade shows. And you talk to another woman, Julie, who works doing this. So that part of the business seems to be less overwhelmingly male, but it still sounds very scattered and competitive and unstable.
Sure. So for first, you broke up for just a second in the middle of that, but I think I got the gist of the question, which is talking about food manufacturers and food producers bringing items to shelf. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Sorry, I'm breaking up. I'm not sure why, but everything is being.
It's just the internet. Mm-hmm. But I got most of it. But yeah, that was another fascinating area. I didn't really know what to expect. I assumed that if I make a good guacamole, and if I wanted to put it in a bottle, then I could probably sell it, and it wouldn't be that hard to do that. And I think a lot of people walk around thinking they have some food product that they could probably get on shelf, and it's way better than Old El Paso's bunk salsa. So, like, why are these greedy companies like not making the good stuff? And really, traveling around with this woman Julie, who made a product called Slasa, which is her combination coleslaw salsa, a relish alternative. Really changed my notion of what it means to be a manufacturer, because not only are you competing against other manufacturers. So if you're making a relish like Julia's, you're competing against ketchup and mustard and traditional relishes, pickles, but you're also competing against the store itself, which has reinvented its business model to some extent. As more of a landlord that's leasing space less as a kind of open market where the best things, products are going to be there. So Julie would constantly be hit up for actual payments for inches on the shelf anywhere, or for free product, or for buy one, get one, free opportunities that these retailers could then use to sell at 100% markup. And that, you know, that really changed my notion. It also just changes the food that's available. It means the cost of getting involved in CPG food is much higher than it used to be. It's really hard to do what Julie was trying to do, which is to grow yourself from kind of the farm stand to the commercial kitchen to the co-packer to the manufacturing plant and slowly build up a business base. Because of these entry fees, you kind of have to have a lot of money up front, which just increases the risk or demands that you partner with a venture capital fund, which of course does operate as kind of a sieve or bottleneck that, you know, is going to favor certain types of products that those gatekeepers are familiar with. And so I think that definitely has some effects on what's gets to market.
Yeah, no, very, I definitely, that was one step, one part of the story I was totally unaware of. But even though, so the world of groceries seems very well connected and scheduled, and but still each of these stores has its own history. And I also want you to talk a little bit more about Whole Foods, because it's also a unique one. A unique story, I mean, and if you can tell us a little bit more about your research process of Whole Foods, because you worked at Whole Foods for kind of what you wanted to do for tracking, but they decided not to do. I'm imagining, but Whole Foods was a little bit easier, and you went through the entire onboarding process, right? How did you negotiate your position as a writer and even as a field researcher with working at this fish counter? I guess that's how you got to know all this about hygiene.
I think it was, as I said, like in the beginning, I really like to try to get as close to things as possible. I wanted to write about the retail floor experience. I very much didn't want to root that entirely in my own experience. So that section is, you know, it's a first person section based on my experience working at the chain, but it's also informed by lots of interviews with other employees that I met along the way. But essentially, I decided that at some point for this grocery store book, I had to like work in a grocery store. So I got a job at Whole Foods. I actually worked at a different competing New York chain for a brief period just so I could get a sense of what another chain was like. You know, it was pretty straightforward. I'm not an academic, so I didn't have an IRB breathing over my neck telling me what I could and can and cannot do. There were certain ethical things that I felt necessary. I told everyone that I was writing a book. I didn't tell them what the book was about. I told them it was about my life, and then I let them fill in the dots about that. You know, when I was on shift, there really wasn't any time to be writing or taking notes for the most part. I kept a notebook handy so that I could write on my breaks, but you know, or jot down ideas that came to me on my breaks. But I was pretty present as an employee throughout that process. And for me, it was just, let me get some first person perspective on a number of these issues. And so I could talk to other employees about their experience with a little bit more credibility and a little bit more understanding than I would otherwise. Which was again, like incredibly helpful. I'm a writer. I've worked a lot of minimum wage jobs in my time. I've worked a lot of service sector jobs, a lot of retail jobs, waited tables, bartended, et cetera, et cetera. Those jobs have changed since I was in college 20 years ago, and not for the better. You know, where I kind of look back on some of my waiting jobs and retail jobs with nostalgia, and there have been real shifts in terms of what's acceptable and how you treat an employee industry wide. Probably the biggest of which has to do with scheduling. So back in the day when I was working retail, we would get our schedule a week in advance, up to 2 weeks in advance. And it was a pretty regular schedule. You worked like a certain days of the week, and those were your days of the week. And you could swap shifts with someone else if you ever wanted to switch things up. And it was that happened pretty informally, but you just tell your manager. Now at a lot of chains, there's something called variable scheduling, or just-in-time scheduling, which is its kind of cousin, which means that you don't have a set schedule. Your schedule changes week to week, day to day, and that you'll get that information just in time, which is to say right before your shift. The ramifications of this are pretty obvious. It means that you have to really hold open all potential shifts because you're on the hook for any of them. And it means that for a minimum wage job, you can't really get a second job to supplement it, or it's much more difficult to, because you don't know exactly when you're going to become free. And, you know, scheduling things like childcare is, of course, very difficult. Now, where I was working at Whole Foods, this was not the case. Whole Foods does not use just-in-time scheduling in name, but because it was kind of the industry standard, there were a lot of moments where we'd be asked to do essentially just-in-time scheduling by the manager. He would give us a new shift, you know, a new schedule. The shift wouldn't be posted till the day before. And we would be kind of asked to be quote unquote team players and play ball for the Whole Foods team, because that was just the standard. And if we didn't, then of course we would have to play for a different team at some other place that was probably doing just in time schedule full time all the time. And that did have, you know, when you ask a lot of employees, and there are studies about this, whether they'd prefer a raise in wages or whether they'd prefer a steady schedule, a lot of them the majority of them will choose the schedule. It's that dehumanizing to get yanked around like that. And of course, you know, these are jobs back when I was doing this that I looked at with nostalgia when I was, you know, college, young person, entry-level jobs. But for more and more people, these are jobs that they're doing over many years and are turning into mini careers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just a different landscape.
Yeah, it is interesting how companies portray themselves towards consumers, but also towards the employees, how they use language like fair trade and associates and team players to legitimate, you know, these probably, I mean, pretty awful, yeah, labor,
pretty nasty
marketing strategies. Over time, you had the example of Walter, for when he wakes up every day when he opens the store in Whole Foods, and he wakes up at 4 a.m. and and he probably didn't know about that time. I mean, that he had to do it until one day before. I think that's cruel. I mean, that's for me as a person that doesn't sleep well, for example, or that needs, you know, a mother, I wouldn't even know how that's even possible to do. Let's go to the last part of the book. I'm also a big fish eater, though I may stop again after reading about forced labor. I did stop a while ago when I read about, you know, decimated oceans and how bad we were treating oceans. And but also I did do this when I drove through California and through the five and through miles and miles of just cows and awful smells, and you just realize what it takes to have meat on your supermarket or on your table every day. But tell us a bit more about this last part of the supply chain when you went to Thailand and you know, were with this with this group of fishermen and with this person Tun Lin, who was working catching fish. Yeah.
So this was I really wanted to get to the bottom of the supply chain, and this was I went to Thailand and used the Thai shrimp industry as an example, but for me, it's just a microcosm of the bottom of a lot of different supply chains. And this was important because, again, grocery is premised on this notion of continuous availability, of just endless volume of goods. And that what that does, that it's just an enormous appetite for things that it's really hard to conceptualize. And the commodity goods that underpin a lot of these things are needed in such voracious demand that, like, the way I thought about them previously to the book doesn't really apply. And I thought about them, I guess, kind of like that cliched flowchart on an office wall that's like raw materials extraction to manufacturing plant to exporter to importer to buyer to store to grocery cart. And that kind of neat flow breaks down under the volume that it takes to stock not just one store, but you know, a whole chain of stores. And so what you have is lots of brokers on the manufacturing level and below who are just buying up raw materials from aggregators themselves and from other brokers who are going around. And it becomes incredibly tangled on the bottom level, so that as a buyer in the first world in America, you often don't have great visibility to what's going on deep in the supply chain because there's just too many different levels, or the levels themselves are broken apart and kind of act as hiding mechanisms. Like, you may have a great deal of clarity on who your five different manufacturers of a product are, but then who those manufacturers are sourcing from and the people those people are sourcing from or outsourcing their labor to becomes very murky. And so all that murkiness creates a great opportunities for abuse. Especially in the world of labor, food being food, we have lots of legal and certificatory regulatory demands on quality and on its safety, all of which create in the commodity side of things kind of a floor that producers need to meet to be able to compete. Like, you have to do XYZ certification. You have to use these type of refrigerators and this type of cooling system and these type of antibiotics to get your product to market. And when there's a price competition with that type of floor, one of the only places you can make cost savings is in the area of labor. And so labor is the place where prices get where price gets cut. And of course, you can only cut labor so much before you really get to places where people are living, you know, undignified lifestyles. But at the bottom of the commodity chain, that type of really abusive labor practices do flourish. And that's certainly what I found at the bottom of the Thai supply chain, where I followed a migrant laborer from Burma who traveled to Thailand seeking a better life and was kidnapped and placed on fishing boats and, you know, forced to work against his will at the threat of beating. Really, there's no other word for this than slave. You know, he watched his friend get murdered in front of him. He lost his hand in the process of working on these boats. And, you know, this just truly horrific story, but by no means some like crazy outlier. This type of bonded labor, trafficked labor, which he was a part of, modern slavery, was made up of, you know, the actual percents get really murky. When I was writing, it was somewhere between 15% and 60%. Which is such a wide range that it's unhelpful, but does speak to the lack of visibility that even NGOs who are studying this sector, you know, really can't qualify it that well. But it's a significant. I mean, we're not talking like 1%. We're not talking about 5%. We're talking, you know, 15 to 60%, which has a big effect on the price and does allow the price competition for, you know, the buyers back home who are absolutely operating on our behalf as consumers. And when we price consume, this kind of like really horrific abuse overseas, and no doubt domestically too. That's just not where I looked, but I'm sure it's happening here too. To really flourish, because there's no other place for those cuts to be made. There's not efficiency gains every year in the manufacturing process that are going to shave off those pennies, but labor is always there as a way you can say that you saved a few pennies.
Right. So to conclude, I wanted to congratulate you on a fascinating account, I think, on the American supermarket. I think that it is impressive research. It's an impressive research accomplishment that not only informs consumers of today, but about a space, right, that they spend a good amount of time through their lives, like you say in your book. But your book is also full of data, of detail about the industry, data that I think historians are commonly not able to get unless there has been an oral history project, like you did, more or less. The voices of truckers are in your books, for example. But, and you mentioned that that this industry is not obsolete, that there is more to write about the American grocery sector. What do you think is the, you know, what is the future of groceries in the US?
I don't know what the future is. I don't have a great crystal ball. I do think there's tons more to write in terms of this question on labor. I mean, in many ways, it's like the question of our age. How do we prevent these races for the bottom from existing? Where's the point that you can intervene? You know, in the book, I've become very disenchanted with the notion that we're going to buy our way to a solution, that the kind of like voting with our dollars and buying the correct product is going to become an answer, which was always the answer that we were told before. Oh, just buy the ethical salmon, not the like, you know, generic salmon. And by doing that, you'll do the right thing. So I don't think that that's the answer. But then I do think what is, and how does one go about reforming a supply chain, and how do you empower workers in a meaningful, long-lasting way? How do you get worker-owned supply chains? You know, how do you get certification regimes, which we didn't talk about much here, but which are hopefully supposed to be guaranteeing these qualities we want in our food, but are in practice not doing a great job of that? How do we get them to be worker oriented so that the workers are the people who are actually doing that certification? Those are big questions that I think require, you know, I know a lot of really, really smart people are thinking about them, but there's still a lot more. And I'm sure those really, really smart people would appreciate lots of help on it.
Right. Do you have a project? Are you working on a project currently that you want to tell us about?
You know, right now I'm kind of in the like in between. I'm like lying fallow, as they say. But I will be. Yes, I have another book that I'm starting up pretty soon, and getting into that mode. But it takes a lot to switch gears for me.
That's good. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great one. Hopefully I didn't ramble too much.
No, it was fantastic. Thank you everyone for listening.